Our scripture reading this morning is taken from Genesis chapter 20. Genesis chapter 20. And we're reading the entire chapter. From there, Abraham journeyed toward the territory of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. And he journeyed in Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." Now Abimelech had not approached her. So he said, "Lord, will you kill an innocent people? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister'? And she herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now then, return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, so that he will pray for you and you shall live. But if you do not return her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours." So Abimelech rose early in the morning and called all his servants and told them all these things. And the men were very much afraid. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you have brought on me and my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done." And Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you see that you did this thing?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there is no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, though not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" Then Abimelech took sheep and oxen and male servants and female servants and gave them to Abraham and returned Sarah his wife to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is a sign of your innocence in the eyes of all who are with you, and before everyone you are vindicated." Then Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and also healed his wife and female slaves so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed all the wombs of the house of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. God will bless his word to our hearts.
While studying in Barcelona, the University of Barcelona in Spain, Rebecca Pippert was making new friends, and she was surprised that some of these friends were curious about her faith, her Christian faith, and they began to ask a number of different questions. And at the urging and the persistence of Rebecca's Christian roommate, who suggested to her to hold some type of study for her non-Christian friends, Rebecca, with fear and trembling, asked her new friends, "Would you like to study about Jesus or study some passages about the Bible, and I'll lead this study?" And to her alarm and surprise, her friend said, "Yes, we'll do that." And so the dates were set for Wednesday evenings where her friends, non-Christian friends, would come to her apartment and study some of the scriptures and talk about Jesus. During the week prior to the very first meeting, Rebecca had met another young lady named Mary. And Mary didn't know that Rebecca was yet a Christian. She didn't have any idea. And in the course of conversation, Mary said this, This has been a tremendous, great month. I've talked 3 people out of becoming Christians this month. What a great month it is. And Rebecca, horrified in her mind, said, "Whew, I'm glad I didn't ask her to come." And the next day after class, Mary found Rebecca and said, "I hear you're having a study next Wednesday. I wouldn't miss that for the world. What a lark that will be. I'll be there." Now, to find out and what goes on and what happened, I'm going to tell you later. Our current sermon series, we've been studying what the church is. We are rediscovering our identity of who we are as the church. And we've looked at and defined the church. We've looked and seen how the church fits in God's overall plans. Then we've looked and begun to study the purposes. Well, what reason and what purpose has God put us together as the church? And so we've completed the very first and primary purpose of the church, that we exist as God's people to worship Him. And then we've just completed last week the second purpose of the church. Because worship of God does not exist in the world, we have the second purpose to evangelize, to give God's message to all the nations, to seek to persuade them of that message so that they too will come to worship. And then we have 2 more purposes of the church: discipleship or disciple making and fellowship. And we're going to take a look at those, but not starting today, because tomorrow I have the opportunity to begin my annual holidays for 3 weeks, so for the next 3 Sundays, you're not going to see me. And I thought, and then we'll have the end of August, and then you'll have the Labor Day weekend with a lot of people away usually, so I thought, let's not start the purpose of discipleship now and then leave it kind of hanging and be inconsistent. So we'll start that on September 8th. That's my plan. So for 3 Sundays today and 2 other ones, one in August and the first of September, I'm going to just do something a little different, though today's message actually fits with the second purpose of the church evangelism. And one of the other messages that I plan to do on September, it relates to the world and it hating the disciples of Christ, and that will be a great background for when we go into discipleship. So they're not completely unrelated. Turn to Genesis 20. Genesis chapter 20, Abraham has been following the command of God. Abraham's a city boy, he's an urbanite. He has been commanded by God to leave the great ancient city of Ur along with his close relatives and all that he owns. And he has to leave his family, has to leave his city and his culture. And he has to become a nomadic wanderer. And he's got over to the land that God has shown him, but he's still a nomad wandering around. And that puts him in danger, because as someone who has no clan, who has no tribe, who has no overlord, then as Abraham travels throughout the Middle East, he has no one to protect him except himself. So he comes into contacts with other peoples, other tribes, other clans, other powerful kings and people. They can easily take advantage of him. However, he has an additional problem. His wife is beautiful. According to ancient Near Eastern standards, whatever they were at that time, even though at this point in Genesis chapter 20, Sarah is 90 years old, according to the ancient Near Eastern standards, she's still hot. And she's attractive. So much so that any powerful person wants to add her to his harem. And that is a danger. The danger, as was stated in the text, is they say, well, if she's a married woman, we'll kill the husband and just take her. So this is Abraham's concern. As I wander, I got this wonderfully beautiful wife that other people, other men are going to desire for their harem, and they're going to kill me if they know I'm the husband. So to deal with this problem, Abraham revealed in verse 13, the standard procedure that they adopted as they traveled from Ur was, they will withhold the truth. They'll tell a half-truth we're brother and sister, which was half true, but didn't tell the whole truth, which is, yeah, we're married, we're husband and wife. And they employ that tactic again and again, and they are employing that tactic again as they leave Mamre, and they move south to the west in the border of Canaan, and there's a map on the next slide. Show you, and you can get your bearings. So they're moving from the central highlands of Palestine, going west towards the Mediterranean Sea, which we call the coastal plain, and they're heading to a city named Gerar, or to an area around Gerar. And that is the early Philistines, very, very early Philistines. And you can just take a look at that map, get your bearings. Now, that lie or that strategy that they were using to save Abraham's life generally worked. However, in this case, it's causing certain consequences that occurred once before back in Egypt, and as recorded in Genesis 13. The lie may save Abraham's life, but it causes Sarah to be taken by a local Philistine ruler, in this case, the king of Gerar. Now, the clear danger here is not just that, oh, okay, they're separated, and now Abraham's wife is part of a harem of the king of Gerar. There's a greater problem here than just that, as significant as that is. If you were to take a look at Genesis chapter 18, just flip back two chapters to verse 10 and verse 14, you will see very clearly that God had promised Sarah and Abraham that within a year of those verses, Genesis 18, or chapter 18, verses 10 and 14, within a year, Sarah and Abraham will have their very own child. And remember, Sarah has been infertile all her life, and she's past the age of childbearing. And so they have a promise from God where they will have their own child. It will be Abraham's sperm, Sarah's egg, their genetic child, their flesh. Now the king of Gerar has taken Sarah for his harem. That promise is in danger. Sarah has finally been made fertile by God, and she's been taken by the king for his harem. They're not going to have their child, are they? Unless something happens. The promise of God is in danger. Now, when God makes a promise, he keeps it. So he intervenes, as you see in the text. He appears to Abimelech in a dream. And he says, look, dude, you've taken a married woman, and you're as good as dead, unless you do what I tell you. Now, it's true, as Abimelech protests, he says, hey, I acted out of ignorance. I didn't know this lady was married. Both she and her husband, her brother, said they were just brother and sister. I acted upon false information. But you know as well as I do that when you do 80 kilometers in a 60-kilometer zone and you honestly didn't see the 60K speed limit sign, you're still guilty. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. So even though you didn't see the sign that says you're now in a 60-kilometer zone and you're doing 80, you are still guilty. You have broken the law. Same thing here. Even though he didn't know Sarah was a married woman, he is still guilty of coveting, and he's guilty of kidnapping a man's wife or taking or stealing a man's wife. He has broken the law. The divine law. Now Abimelech pleads. He appeals to God's justice. He says, look, I didn't do it willingly. I didn't intentionally take another man's wife. If I had known, I wouldn't have taken her. And God responds. He says, I know this. So that's why I kept you, Abimelech, from touching her. I kept you from having sex with her. Because he caused some disease and some other stuff there that mentioned at the end of the chapter. So he says, I kept you from that so you would not commit adultery along with your other sins of coveting and stealing a man's wife. So I kept you from sinning against me in terms of adultery. But if you don't listen to me, God says, you will die. So you go and make things right. But before we go on, and before we look at how Abimelech makes things right, let's stop there for a moment in verse 6. Notice God's words. Yes, I know that you have done this in the integrity of your heart, and it was I who kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Did you notice that God says, if Abimelech had had sex with Sarah and committed adultery, Abimelech would not be sinning so much against Sarah or Abraham, but God says, you're going to be sinning against me. I kept you from sinning against me, God says. So adultery, like any sin, is a sin against God himself. Though Abimelech is not a worshiper of God, yet God is his creator, and God holds him account for his actions and his breaking of God's laws, and he punishes the breaking of those laws. He will hold him for accountable of his sin of ignorance. And he said, if you had committed adultery, which I didn't let you, you would have sinned against me. This is shocking words for our society. First of all, most people, as we learned in our just a few weeks ago about God's message we're to tell to the nations, most people don't believe God is their creator and that they're accountable to him. I don't have to give an account to God. This is shocking. What? I have to account to God. He shall be my judge. Huh. They laugh in disbelief. They mock it. So these words, from that perspective, are a shock, a slap across the face. But not only that, what is the particular sin here? It's adultery. Adultery is so commonplace in our society. Adultery is an acceptable way in the workplace to get ahead. You have sexual relations and trysts at work so that you can advance your career. It's commonplace. It's acceptable in our modern society. It's not a sin. It's a way to advance your career. And then given also the general comments that you hear ad nauseum when politicians get into these adulterous situations and it becomes public, they all start shouting, well, you know, what happens in the bedroom happens in the bedroom, and it's our private business and it's nobody else's. Well, this tells us that God's in the bedroom, God's in the workplace, God's at the hotel, and he knows of every adulterous act and every other form of sexual immorality, and he says, you're sinning against me. You're disobeying me, you're offending me, and I shall punish your sin. You see, adultery is a sin against God because God designed marriage. And the scriptures tell us God designed marriage and defines marriage as one man and one woman married for life until one of them dies. And that's it. And sex is only for a married man who is married to the woman. And sex is not allowed outside that union. And that's the only kind of marriage there is, and the only safe and proper place for sex is between the man and the woman who are married to each other. Nothing else allowed. Go outside that boundary, you shall harm yourself, and you shall incur the wrath of God upon yourself. So let us not just rush past this verse, let us take that phrase, I kept you from sinning against me. And let us not ignore the lesson to our peril. Abimelech. All right, he wastes no time correcting the situation, but he hauls Abraham up before him and he says, dude, you're going to give an account to me. You know, why did you bring all this trouble on us? What did we do that you brought all this trouble on us? Why did you lie to us? Why did you deceive us? Look at the fix we're in now because of you. Now, one of Abraham's lame excuses is in verse 11. He goes, I thought there was no fear of God at all in his place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Well, in some sense, his excuse makes sense. Terence Freetham notes that the fear of God can be understood as being in tune with the basic order of things as God created them, including interhuman relationships, with all that means in terms of basic human values such as life, truth, and justice. End quote. In other words, Abraham is assuming that the population of Gerar don't fear God, they don't worship God, so they won't follow the basic proper way God has for us to relate to each other with basic hospitality, justice, civility, and fairness. Now, where would he get an idea like this? Sodom and Gomorrah. Just go back one chapter into chapter 19, and we see how Sodom treated its guests that come into the city. Gang rape and all this type of stuff. So Abraham goes, you know, these people, they don't fear God. So these people in Gerar are probably just like Sodom and Gomorrah. We need to be extra careful. They won't have that fear of God that causes them to treat everybody with justice and civility. But in this case, Abraham's wrong. He's wrong. He misreads this group and Abimelech completely wrong. And we see that Abimelech actually does fear God, as seen in his quickly accepting God's word and command to him. We see that as he gives sheep, slaves, and cattle to Abraham, which shouldn't be interpreted that Abimelech is all of a sudden just trying to gain favor with Abraham. No. As he gives these sheep and these slaves and the cattle to Abraham, he's actually doing it to please God, not Abraham, because he understands Abraham is the prophet. So how you treat the prophet, you treat the one who sent him. You treat and show your respect to the God for whom the prophet speaks. So he's giving all this stuff, all these things to Abraham, because he recognizes he's a prophet. The silver he gives to Sarah to just make a public statement for everybody. He says, look, she did nothing wrong. You know, she wasn't chasing me. She wasn't flirting with me. We've had no relations whatsoever. It was a complete and utter mistake. She's pure. And here's the silver to show and give evidence that, you know, this is the way it is. And then Abimelech invites Abraham to stay around. He says, here's my land, my territory. Wander through it. And he says, you know, why is he doing it? Again, he knows Abraham's a prophet, and he needs that prophet of the God who spoke to him in the dream to bless him and to pray for him and to heal him. So you treat the prophet right, then the God whom that prophet represents will bless you and his family. Ed Dobson writes, the truth was that Abraham was the one who didn't fear God. When Abraham looked around, he was more afraid of Abimelech and his kingdom than he was of God. If Abraham had truly feared the Lord, he would have obeyed and trusted him. End of quote. Now, instead of fearing God, did you notice in verse 13 something that Abraham said? Again, another excuse for his sin and his lying. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, this is the kindness you must do to me at every place to which we come. Say of me, he is my brother. So he's saying, well, you know, kind of Abimelech, you know, when God told me to move from Ur, you know, I had to develop this plan. And this is where the lie come from. So he's blaming God. We never get out of that, do we? Ever since Adam and Eve. Blame somebody else and blame God half the time for our troubles and our sin. When we fear and when we respect, honor, love humans more than we love, fear, and honor God, we will cease, like Abraham, to be a blessing to others. And we'll even cause them to sin. We must fear God and not fear men and women. Because when we start fearing men and women, we will cease to be the witnesses we are to be. we will cease to be an avenue of blessing and we will become a curse to people like Abraham became a curse to people in this chapter. Abraham was chosen to be a blessing to the nations, but he assumes that these Philistines cannot be influenced by him, perhaps like Lot couldn't influence Sodom. So Abraham, as David Turner mentions, in this case, ceases to be a proper testimony for God because he starts lying. He becomes a bad prophet, a bad representative of God with his lies and his lack of trust and his lack of fear of God. Now, all of us, well, those of you who claim that you have received Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior and have repented of your sin, you are the children of God. You're the church. And at no time do you stop being witnesses. The question is not when you get up in the morning, shall I witness today or shall I not? Wrong question, throw it away. The right question is, because I am the church, because I am the child of God, because I am a Christian, will I be a good witness that brings honor to the Lord through all my actions and speech and my lifestyle? Or will I be a bad witness that dishonors and slanders God's name through my actions and my speech and my lifestyle? See, the question isn't whether you will or won't witness. The question is whether you are a good one or a bad one. That's the only question. Let's go back to Mary, the open antagonist. So after composing herself in the bathroom, Rebecca comes out and hopes to make some small talk and believes that Mary is going to disappear very quickly and leave. But she's stunned that Mary actually asks a number of questions and a two-hour conversation continues about faith. And then as Mary leaves, Rebecca gives Mary a small booklet by John Stott called Basic Christianity. She says, in her literal words, were, if you could read it sometime in the next 2 years. I pick up the account here from her book, Out of the Salt Shaker and Into the World, Evangelism as a Way of Life. The next day, the others who were supposed to come to the study apologized and said they had completely forgotten. But they promised they would be there next Wednesday. And next Wednesday came. I felt reassured. God wouldn't let me go through another experience like that. And once more, I asked several Christians in Barcelona to pray. So 7 o'clock came, then 7:10, 7:15, 7:20. And finally, the doorbell rang. I ran to the door, eager to see my friends. I threw open the door, but only one person was standing there, Mary. Once more, she took a quick look around and said, this Bible discussion is really dynamite, isn't it? I've never seen such crowds. That did it. This was the closest thing to martyrdom I'd experienced. Mary, would you excuse me for a minute? I'll be right back, I said, and rushed into the bathroom again. I didn't understand, but I returned to Mary, hoping she would quickly leave so I could cry later. Instead, she said, I read that book you gave me. I came to that chapter on sin. And I wanted to hide under the bed. It never occurred to me as she spoke that the Holy Spirit was convicting her of sin. I merely thought it was a strange but interesting response. She plied me with questions and told me a great deal about her life and her family. I began to glimpse for the first time who she was, a sensitive young woman who covered her questions and wounds effectively. I was moved as she shared her life, and I genuinely cared for her. Still, her initial disdain and negativity towards Christianity intimidated me. I thought perhaps God was seeking her. What I didn't see was that her badgering me with questions, her coming to the study, even her hostility and anger were signs she was grappling with God. Then came the bomb. She suddenly looked straight at me and said, I feel like God is over there, as she gestured with her hand, and I'm over here. I've really wanted to know God all my life, but how do I bridge the gap? What would I do if I wanted to become a Christian? Like Abraham, Mary had different assumptions about who was or was not open to God. So Abraham had assumed Abimelech and the people of Gerar will not be open to God. They'd be just probably like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Mary, Rebecca, assumed because of the antagonistic stance that Mary had expressed about Christianity and even talking Christians out of their faith, that she would not be interested. Actually, when I thought about it, it was Mary's friends, the ones who on the outside said, "Yeah, we're interested, we're curious, we'll come to your study," but never showed up. They're the ones who were closed, at least initially. She didn't go on and tell about what happened later in the rest of the studies. So it was the ones who seemed to be favorable who were the ones who had the hard hearts. It was the one who was outwardly bombastic and rude and antagonistic. That was the one, when the truth came out, their heart was becoming soft towards God. And God was at work in that person's life, in Mary's life. So you're the church. You're the people God has chosen to send out into the world, into this community and beyond, to be his witnesses. Now, what assumptions do you carry about the people you're meeting and that you work with, the people that you go to school with, the people that are your neighbors? Do you assume, perhaps prematurely, that they have no fear of God? Then you think, I know this person, I've known them for 15 years, they're still hard as a rock, I'm not going to bother talking to them about Christianity. Or, I've heard this person say this, and I'm just going to assume they have no hunger for God, so we ignore them, we stay in our own little coffee groups, our own little Christian coffee groups, and our own little Christian small groups, and our own Christian little friendships, and we don't mix, and we don't get connected with the non-Christians, talking about them with the gospel, with the message that I explained to you in the last few weeks, the message God gave us to tell the world. Or perhaps because of our assumptions, we just assume, because we have to interact with non-Christians, right, when you go to work and you go to school. But perhaps you say, well, we just talk about work. We just talk about leisure activities and sports and the weather. It'll be off limits. Morality. Let's not talk about euthanasia. Let's not talk about abortion. Let's not talk about same-sex marriage. Let's not talk about spiritual things. Let's not talk about the Bible, the existence of God, Jesus. We'll just keep silent. Why? If God could use Abraham's mess and foul up to reveal himself to Abimelech, imagine what God can do through you if you begin to pray earnestly for a couple neighbors, a couple workmates, a couple schoolmates every week or even daily and say, God, I want to talk to them about the gospel and about you. Give me an opportunity and give me the courage. Imagine how God will use you if you just start to ask him. We don't have to foul up like Abraham for God to step in. We can just let God use us and say, here am I, send me. Will the praise team come and lead us in song?